football on off the ball.
There was an ad for 4 tickets to the final at a cost of $2.3 million each. $2.3 million what? Each for a ticket to the final, yeah.
Join in the obsession.
Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
This is Off the Ball Breakfast.
Ireland's sports breakfast show.
Off the ball. GAA.
I don't think Cork allowed Limerick to maybe have that opportunity to get a score to bring it back to a draw. And Cork at the other side, I thought were ruthless in terms of that ball that went into Brian Hayes to pop off the shoulder to Darragh Fitzgibbon. It was just a really well-worked score, and I think that Cork probably, they were full value and probably deserved that win because Limerick were probably, they probably should have kicked on, but Cork didn't allow them.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
Off the Ball Breakfast
with Viagra Connect 50 milligram film coated tablets. Contains sildenafil for adult men with erectile dysfunction. Maximum dosage 150 milligram tablet per day. Always read the label. Buy online at viagraconnect.ie. Subject to suitability following pharmacist consultation.
Okay, good morning. Off the Ball Breakfast here on a Friday morning. Mick McCarthy in. The man that I was let in today, my day of jubilation after Aston Villa's 4-0 win over Nottingham Forest last night. Europa League final, here we come. Delighted to be joined, as always, by Enda and Dara. How you doing, lads?
Good.
How's it going?
Not as good as you, but...
No. And Keith Tracy, good morning to you.
Morning, lads. How are we?
You had your day of jubilee in here on Wednesday morning. You wore your Arsenal hoodie. I decided I could do likewise this morning. The bar was set.
The bar was set.
And I think met, yeah?
Yeah, but I'm having more than just a day. I'm still on cloud nine. Until West Ham going torn is over on Sunday, I'm going to be flying high.
A game you can hear live on Off the Ball with one Keith Tracy on commentary, I believe.
I thought I'd better take my Arsenal top off before the game rolls
around. That's fair enough. Yeah, there are a few West Ham fans out there. Let's have a quick look at what's coming up on this morning's show. We will be going through the papers, which are now in the next couple of minutes. We're going to have Roscommon legend Donny Smith on the line. Roscommon looking for their first Connacht title since 2019, when Donny would have been playing against Galway this weekend. We look ahead to what's been a really interesting year for Roscommon so far. And at 8:45 or so, we will have Quinny in to talk about the Ireland-Wales game this weekend, of course, and about Munster, of course, who play Connacht this week, and some interesting comments from Clayton McMillan. We'll mention them when we go through the papers in a couple of minutes. And after 9 o'clock then, we will have Rachel Sheehan in for all the latest on LGFA and Camogie, and of course, a new pair of shorts that actually might sound trivial, but is actually an unbelievable new development in the apparel of basically the first pair of shorts that were designed for women, and it is a game changer for women's football and Camogie players. So we'll hear more about that after 9 o'clock this morning. But let's get to the top of the show, the start, first talking point, lads. Look, I mean, normally I couldn't legitimately do this, but I think I actually can start with Villa last night. I was saying this, Keith, the power of sport and what it can do for you, and you'll understand this, right? So on Sunday last week, the two loves of my life in a sporting sense are the Clare Hurlers and Aston Villa football team. And I watched Clare getting absolutely hammered by Limerick, a really disconsolate day, turned on Villa later on, you know, kind of not even too worried about it. Put in possibly the worst display they've put in under Unai Emery, save Spurs, which is a problem all in itself, you would say. And I'm just like, I hate sport. I just don't want to do this anymore. Why? It takes too much out of me. I'm just down. I'm down as a person. And then on Wednesday night, I put on the under-20s hurling Munster semi-final where Clare beat Cork in a thriller, but a really, really good performance. I just got a little bit lifted. I was like, you know, there's a future in this, you know. And then last night, Villa literally put the opposite performance in to what they did last Sunday. They were at it from minute one. They attacked brilliantly. They won all the 50-50 balls all the way through the game, and were just put in the type of performance that makes you believe in Unai Emery again. Not that we ever doubted, of course. But, you know, it's just, it's amazing how quickly you can turn around. The endurance of sport to just keep you coming back and back and getting you. That positivity will always come back to you.
Do you think it was the right decision now for Emery to go a little bit under strength on the weekend against Spurs? Because I know the Villa fans weren't happy at all after the result. But given what's happened last night, you're prepared to go, yeah, right decision to not...
Yeah.
You know, give up on the Spurs game, but to prioritise last night over Spurs.
I was fine with the team selection last week. I think that's an understandable thing. I think it would take a massive collapse and also a confluence of events where other teams win games are not expected to, for Villa not to get in the top five now at this stage, right? So you can understand putting the league to one side and concentrating on Forest. The issue I think Villa fans had was the team that you did put out there didn't seem to try a leg.
Yeah.
And they didn't. There was no sense that, like, you know, they were fighting for places for next Thursday. There was no sense that there was any kind of momentum. And yeah, it was just the performance, really. It was the, like, not creating an attack until, I don't know, like halfway through the second half. They barely came out their own half. See, and you're just like, what's going on here? Like,
I think this is why being, and I think Unai Emery, I'm delighted for him. Obviously, being an Arsenal fan, I thought he got a raw deal at Arsenal. And
yeah, you're one of the few, actually. We've said that before.
I thought that Arsenal team he had was bang average. And I thought he'd done okay. I don't think he did poorly. I don't think he set the world on fire. I thought he did okay. But when you look at Villa's performance on the weekend, you could tell that those players were getting put out to think, we're wrapping the other players in cotton wool, and that was the performance they gave. Like, well, we're not really here because the manager wants us to start. It's, we're just biding time. But when you look at Mikel Arteta plays Miles Lewis-Skelly centre midfield against Fulham, and you're thinking, well, he's only in there because Zubimendi and Rice are a little bit tired and he's filling a gap. Yeah, the Atletico Madrid semi-final second leg comes around and Arteta's, I believe his words were, I'm really sorry, but I'm starting the same lads as I did against Fulham.
Yeah.
So there's always a chance. There's always a chance that the manager says, yeah, you weren't in my plans originally, but my God, you were really, really good on the weekend. And there always has to be a carrot. There always has to be. And I was always one of those players that mentally, if you told me, play well, Keith, on the weekend and you're in, if it was a reserve game, I think it doesn't matter what I do today, I'm not getting in. But given what Arteta did with Lewis Skelly, there's always a way in. And I thought the Villa players looked like they weren't really motivated for it. They had eyes on bigger things. But there is a European final to look forward to now. So I think that will be forgotten about pretty quickly.
For sure. You're a big fan of John McGinn. Got the two goals last night.
Love him. Absolutely love him. He's a player that... These players that I wouldn't call him particularly quick. I wouldn't say he's particularly good on the ball. He can see a pass, he can do all that type of stuff, but more often than not, when John McGinn gets the ball, there's somebody breathing down his neck. Not like a David Silva who just floats into lovely little pockets of space and you can't get near him. You will be able to get near him, but he uses his arse as a weapon so well. And you get taught this as a young player in academies. You know, you do a thing called King of the Castle where everybody has a ball and you've got to go and kick somebody else's out and so on and so forth till the last person is standing. That's, you get used to shielding the ball with your body. And my God, I just wouldn't want to tackle the man. And he seems to be really composed and he's finishing now with two lovely finishes last night. And I've said it for probably 2 years now, I think he's one of the most underrated players in the Premier League because he's not all, you know, 50 yard pass, 50 yard doyak, free kick into the top corner. But have a look at the amount of times he'll take the ball on his own 18-yard box under pressure and won't lose it. Mm. He's a player that you can trust, and it hasn't been. It's been a gradual rise. Championship, Premier League. I think he's a brilliant, brilliant player, and I think the Villa fans take them to his heart. I think he's a wonderful player and a brilliant captain as well, and somebody that all young lads can look up to and think, that's somebody I want to be. Want to be my role model.
Yeah, and funnily enough, he's never been better. Like, he's never been more important to Villa when they went through an awful run of form when he had a hamstring injury that thankfully wasn't too bad a couple of months ago, and they just rely on him so much at the moment, and he just does everything. You see it last night, like his workout, the right winning corners from nothing with three lads around him, and just smart footballer, a really smart footballer. And he said something after the game that was kind of interesting, and Andy, you were talking about the nearliness of Celtic not paying another 500 grand for him to get him when he left for Hibs, but he said that, like, his journey is like Steve Bruce telling him he could play in England, then Dean Smith telling him he could play in the Premier League, then Steven Gerrard making him captain. Now, in fairness, he had an awful run of form under Gerrard, which was, but Gerrard made him a leader, and then Emery's brought him now to that next level again, like, you know, where hopefully he'll be lifting a European Cup for Villa in a couple of weeks' time. So he's had an unbelievable journey. One other player I want to talk about, and we'll talk about Forrest then in a second, was Ollie Watkins, because obviously the World Cup is looming as well, and he wasn't anywhere near the squad, and it looked like he'd slipped down to kind of fifth or sixth position.
Still doing good though, I think.
He might only bring two strikers, like, you know, Harry Kane plus one, an actual out and out nine. But his form since then has got better and better. But last night, I thought his movement for the goal was really, really good. But his overall play, he's just back at that level again where you were thinking a couple of years ago Arsenal might go and get him, or he's just found that rhythm in his game again. And I just, do you know what, getting a couple of tap-ins sometimes is all you need, because he was getting stuck in one-on-one situations where you knew he wasn't going to score and the rest of his game was suffering as well. I thought he was brilliant last night.
I agree. I thought he was brilliant. I think Unai Emery has improved Ollie Watkins again. I look at Ollie Watkins and I look at most English strikers these days and I feel a little bit sorry for them if their name is not Harry Kane, because there's only one striker starting up front for England.
100%, and it's a battle to get on the plane to back like, up Harry Kane.
If you're like, going as a striker and your name is not Harry Kane, you're going as a number two and you're going to be doing, you know, when there's a game on whatever during the week and the next day everybody's cooling down, you're the one doing the running and you're looking at Harry thinking, I'm not getting in. It doesn't matter. It must be such a difficult place to be. But if Harry Kane gets injured, I was listening to Glenn Hoddle talk about this on a podcast during the week, you know, England's chances dramatically fall without Harry Kane in that team. And we can sit here and say the strength and depth and this and that and the other. Ollie Watkins in for Harry Kane is not the same thing. I take your point, Mick. Ollie Watkins has been brilliant. I thought Buendia has gone to another level under Emery. His feet last night for the first goal were unbelievable. I didn't see him being that good. When I was watching Buendia at Norwich, I thought they
spent a lot of money on him and it was a big risk. Like,
and to be fair, the money they spent, I thought, I'm not sure. I'm really not sure. But Buendia seems to be unlocked under Unai Emery as well and getting that little bit better. And I think that's, you know, you can look at results and performances and, you know, what Emery has done with Villa. But getting individual players to the next level, I think, is something that all top managers have to do. And Emery seems to be able to do it quite easily.
Yeah. What about Forrest then? Like, Andy Reid was talking on TV last night about the amount of injuries they have, and it's like, it's not an excuse, but I do need to mention it, but you had like three of their top players sitting on the bench and obviously not usable. Larry, you were talking about, like, everyone would have seen Morgan Gibbs-White's face, like the fact that he was even on the bench.
I think it
seems almost irresponsible, didn't it?
Yeah, I think it's crazy. I think it's a crazy decision. Like, yeah,
it was, they very were never unlikely to bring him on though.
It was very unlikely to ever play that game, but to be on the bench, there's certain things that have to happen. He has to be passed fitness wise, and he clearly was not in any shape to play that game. He had two black eyes and obviously the stitched wound going across his forehead, and it's like irresponsible even to have him on the bench. And God forbid if they were going into that game the last 10 minutes and it was 1-1, they felt like they needed a Morgan Gibbs-White to come on. Don't put that in the manager's hands. I'm not saying they would have put him on, but like, that shouldn't even be a conversation. I thought it was crazy. Can I actually talk about, I want to talk about, we've been chatting about it a bit over the last week or so, like the, not even the resurrection of number nines, it's like number nines kind of discovering themselves again and like finding a place in football, especially in English football again, like Ollie Watkins scoring goals like he should, Calvert-Lewin as well, another one. Jokeres last couple of games has actually started to figure out what his role is. Like, you don't have to do too much. I suppose with a player like Harry Kane, it creates this kind of idea that, you know, your striker has to be offering you so much more than just goals. You don't really.
Yeah. The ball needs to stick to you, Keith, though, doesn't it? Like, that's what Jokeres has done better. Yeah, in the last few games than he did before, and then the goals kind of come, don't they? That gives you confidence. Thing, yeah. And
but like Harry Kane dropping deep and linking the play and doing all that lovely stuff is great, and it is a bonus in terms of a centre forward. But the other extreme to that is Erling Haaland, who doesn't really get involved in that and just, you know, scores goals for you. I think everybody wants a hybrid, somebody that can do a little bit of both. But as a winger, whenever I came inside and I had a number nine who would face up and be a target man, I mean, it's the easiest thing in the world just to roll a ball into a big centre forward's feet and get some penetration in behind. He pins the centre half. I mean, I did it with John Parkin, whose nickname was obviously the Beast. It was brilliant playing with players like that. But yeah, Gyökeres is somebody, like, people keep telling me he's not an elite striker and he's not the answer for Arsenal. I think he's been absolutely fine, and I think his performances are getting better and better. And that out ball, when you're undercut, when you're under pressure and you just chip it into the channel and he backs into centre halves, yeah, wins free kicks, I think that's a brilliant out ball. And so much of modern football is, well, when they have it, we'll press. How do you take that press away? Chip it over their heads. It's a really easy thing to do, but people are always reluctant. Oh, we want to prove we can play through the press. Just get it up to that big man and play from there.
Is he actually playing any better, or are they just using him a bit more? I feel like there was all that talk, and it's hard to know whether any of it's true, that the Arsenal players didn't really trust him or certainly weren't using him enough anyway. Whereas against Atleti the other night, like, it did feel like that they were happy to use Gyökeres as a player in the build-up, I suppose, in that hold-up kind of way. And he's just a lot more involved, and he seems like he's well able to do it, like, you know?
I think it all just depends on who's actually playing with him. Like, I'd love to see the statistics behind how many times Eze, Saka, Gyökeres were all on the pitch together. Yeah. Because that's sort of the element that's freeing up Gyökeres, because instead of having to come into that space where the number 10 plays to get the ball, Eze is there between the lines to receive it, and that opens up Bukayo Saka to out wide, which opens up the defence a little bit more for Gyökeres to get in behind. So I think the lineup Arsenal has impacted Gyökeres quite a bit, because he's had to do stuff that he's not particularly good at, and then also the complementary players around him probably didn't really help. But I think he, like Keith said, he's fine. And like, everyone put so much onus on stats and goals and assists and everything so far, and in current football it means so much, but if you score any amount of goals in a title winning season, you've played a role. And I know you have to play a bigger role if there's a bigger price tag, but if we get to the end of the season, Arsenal win the league and they're in the Champions League final regardless of whether they win that, if Gyökeres has 15 goals to his name in the Premier League, that's
right back.
And he's scoring them now. That's fine. When the form has been patchy and they've needed to be scraping out goals, your striker's been getting the goals. I think that's a win.
He's also been accused of being a flat track bully a bit this season. And look, the numbers do back that up. He has scored against the weaker sides, but again, to be a title-winning side, you also need to score your goals against the weaker sides. So if he's doing that, and if somebody else is getting the goals against the tougher sides,
I think there's going to be a natural evolution in the play as well. When you think of Arsenal's wingers, if it's Trossard on the left and Saka on the right, Trossard generally won't go down the wing and run away from anybody. Saka has the ability to run away from people around the outside, but will generally come inside. Fulham on last weekend, when they crossed the ball into the box, Gyökeres looked really, really dangerous. Scored two goals, looked an absolute handful. But like I say, the Arsenal wingers like to come inside. The amount of times I see Rice and Zubimendi, even Odegaard, with that straight ball into his feet, and they think, I don't really want to play it. I do think there's a little bit of a trust issue in there, but he's getting better all the time, and this is his fourth season in the Premier League. I think his ceiling is really, really high. And yeah, I'm absolutely delighted with him. And if you look at Saka's numbers, all the wingers and couple of the midfielders in terms of Rice and Zubimendi, even Odegaard, if they can get up near double figures next season, Arsenal will be absolutely flying with their defensive solidity. They've got everything they need.
What did you make of the other semi-final Wednesday night?
I never thought it was going to be another classic as the first leg was. I'm terrified of PSG. I mean, it's some of the things they've done over the last 2 years. I haven't ever seen a team go to Anfield and just play without pressure and just play without that edginess coming in. I mean, every time you listen to the United ex-players on podcasts, and Gary Neville, Roy Keane, they talk about going to Anfield and it feeling different and it feels like the crowd are on top of you. PSG weren't having any of that. Just not having absolutely any of it. And you just keep batting these English teams off. I personally do still think the Premier League is the best league in the world, but I think PSG are the best team. Obviously, there's no other real French teams that you'd be afraid of, but PSG doing what they're doing. Like Marquinhos 1v1 with Luis Diaz. Imagine being Marquinhos and the manager telling you, look, you're playing centre-half, but when they get the ball, I want you to go and stand on that absolutely rapid Colombian. Really, me? Yeah, you.
And he's pushing on.
And he was excellent. Yeah. Absolutely excellent. So I'm delighted for Luis Enrique as well. He's a manager that whenever he talks, I find myself getting really into what he's saying, and he seems very a brilliant manager, very well. He can motivate people very well. And even the Usman Dembele slapping him on the wrist last season and getting the tune out of him, kind of at Skellia. Like, the work rate of the wingers he has is absolutely next level. And Bayern Munich, very, very good team, but I'm delighted they got knocked out because we've avoided the Harry Kane narrative now of Bayern Munich winning 1-0.
And you know what? The revenge for last year's semi-final, I think, is probably... It might not be a bigger talking point, but it's a better one. Like, it's a better storyline going into the thing than former Spurs player playing against Arsenal.
Saka mentioned it, well, not directly, but alluded to it in his post.
Is that what he was talking about?
Yeah, I think so,
Mika Richards,
You'd assume so, yeah. Can I give you a mad Marquinhos stat?
Yeah.
Just because Keith mentioned him there. He has started just 9 League One games since February. Played 90, a grand total of 90 domestic minutes since the middle of February. And he has started all 14 of 16 Champions League games.
He's just a
Champions League like a Champions League specialist for PSG at the minute. The Athletic had that up.
Pacho beside him. Like, it sounds like a player you would have played with at Belvedere.
Pacho,
Pacho O'Neill or something like that, you know? But,
that was a Pancho, but not a Pacho,
What would be his real name? I also have a really, really interesting Unai Emery stat if you want to throw that at
you. We'll resort back
to that. So, Unai Emery has managed 46% of Europa League finals since 2014. He has managed, he's reached 6 finals, 4 different clubs, 13 seasons. Sevilla did 2014, 2015, 2016, Arsenal 2019, Villarreal in 2021, and Aston Villa in 2026. He's won 4 out of the 5.
That's the thing as well. He's reached a bunch of them, but he's won most of them as well.
Yeah.
That's a pretty important stat.
It's easy to be blindsided by the final coming up and the success that Emery's had in the European trophies. They were floating near relegation zone when he first came in. Mm-hmm. So not just domestically and not just in Europe, he's improving Villa all over the place.
You were on with us tonight. It was Nathan was presenting, and it was I was dragged into studio because Villa had got beaten by Fulham, and it was a Steven Gerrard, like, it had all gone to hell. And I remember specifically talking about John McGinn being like turned into this player that was like ironically cheered when he was taken off after 60 minutes because it was so, his form was so bad that you couldn't believe he was still playing, and it was like this hero of Villa Park was turning into an almost laugh figure. And it's just like what Emery has done, and I think they were outside a relegation zone on goal difference that night. It was in like October, it was very early in the season, but they had collapsed. And for what he's done since then, to go to, I think, 7th that first year, with half a season, got into the Conference League, finished 4th the year after, Champions League now it looks like 2 years out of 3, European football 4 years in a row, and possibly, hopefully, a Europa League trophy at the end of it. Like, it is a remarkable turnaround. They haven't spent nothing, Villa, but they've been fairly tied, and this isn't, weirdly enough, if you look at the starting team, it's not a million miles away from what Dean Smith had. Yeah. 2 managers ago. Like, it's not a transformed team. They actually have not done well in the transfer market. So it is an unbelievable testament to what a manager can do when they get it right. It's funny, you're talking about like how important is the manager now, and you're looking right, what's the top 5 in the Premier League? It's like Guardiola is the most important person at that club. Arteta is the most important person at that club. Emery certainly is. Michael Carrick might not yet be, but if you look at what's happened, like, Amorim was in his own way because it obviously was getting so little out of that team.
But look at Mainu now, and players like that have completely rejuvenated off the back of Carrick's confidence he's putting them. Like,
100%. So it's like we can talk down the fact that, like, you know, Chelsea might not see a manager as the most important person at a club, but I don't think you're getting any success unless you have that kind of transformative figure who can take it all on.
Yeah, you need somebody that you have a relationship with, and I've said this for God knows how long under Chelsea. They'll buy an awful lot of good players. They'll win a handful of games because they're talented boys, but nobody's going into the dressing room and having a bit of banter because you'll probably be sold in a couple of months. And the turnover is, the business model is just not right. It's nobody gets success like that. And, you know, I'm sure the American owners will come back at me and say, well, financially, we've done this, that, or the other. That's great, but football isn't ran like that. It's weighed in trophies, and if you're Chelsea, won the Champions League a handful of years ago, should be doing an awful lot better with what they have. And at the minute, I'd go as far to say they're an absolute laughing stock, to be honest. When Liam Rossini came in, the sort of stuff he was coming across with, I mean, what were he, 5-0 down in the European game, and he's handing on notes to Garnacho. what on earth could that have said? That would have made that give any credence to anything. You'd have read that and gone, what's he on about? Just let's just go home. And then the respect the ball stuff, Enzo getting thrown out of the team when he said he'd love to live in Madrid one day, Cucurella then coming out and giving out about the hierarchy, but there's no punishment for that. It just seemed a little bit all over the place. And I know football has moved on since I was playing, but the manager, coach, whatever you want to call them, whatever the modern day title is, they're the most important people in the building.
Yeah.
They can bring everybody together, or they can divide everybody.
But even when you tell stories of your career, and obviously you would have had a lot of managers, I feel like there's two people on either end, like in, say, Eddie Howe and Sean Dyche for you, say, who you would look at in terms of their influence on you two different ways. Yeah. You know what I mean? One negative, one positive. But it was all about what they were bringing. You couldn't thrive under the style of one of them, and the other one got the most out of you. But like, you're in the same dressing room, the same team. It was all about that one figure. Like.
Yeah, no, you're right. But ultimately, the difference between how I went about it and how Sean Dyche and Eddie Howe went about it with me was, I felt when I was playing football for Burnley under Eddie Howe, I had to prove him wrong. Like, he didn't think I was a good player. Whereas Sean Dyche, I felt everybody else didn't think I was a good player, but he thought I was, and I was trying to prove him right. Mm. And ultimately, if you have a manager that thinks you're this and that and tells you to your face, I love you, son, if you lose that belly, you'll be the first name on my team sheet, you start to believe it and get into it. But if the other manager's saying, well, you need to lose that, I'm not sure you'll ever do, I'm not sure you'll get into this team, I'm not sure why we signed you, son, you start thinking, well, I'm not going to run through brick walls for you.
Mm. Yeah.
And honestly, managers are the most important people. And I've always gravitated to the nuts and bolts of football clubs. I've always had relationships with the boot men. I've always had relationships with the tea ladies, with the chefs. That's where you get the inner workings of the club. But the manager, when you go and speak to these people, the chefs, the boot cleaners, the people who do the laundry, you'll get a flavour for what the manager is really like, because they will tell you what he's like when he deals with them. And yeah, the managers are of utmost importance, and I think a lot of people get that wrong these days.
Yeah.
It's sort of the Yankification of football, though, isn't it? Like, it has happened.
General manager.
It genuinely is. Yeah. They think that the general manager, the sporting director, is God now. And I'm not saying that it doesn't have merits. And it's also the statification of football as well. They look at, you know, player, you know, styles, and, you know, does his style suit our style of play, and, you know, does he have the right characteristics? It's almost like you're playing a video game now. Mm. And it does have success with clubs like, you know, Brighton have obviously done it. There are clubs across Europe that have done it and have had success, but if you look at it, it's always the mid-sized teams that it's always like a team that can do better than they're currently doing, but they have, and they're doing it on a limited budget. I think if you look at across at the Champions League, you need that manager as God model.
Like Chelsea trying to take Brighton's model suggests that you can just do the same thing on a bigger level.
Exactly.
And I think it's fairly
and
close.
The question is like, you're Chelsea, why are you acting like Brighton? You know what I mean? Yeah. And we were chatting to Graham Hunter yesterday about PSG and Luis Enrique, and he said Luis Enrique went into the club and they said, you have full control. The sporting director will work with you, but you have full control, and he has full control over everything. And that's what Fergie worked with.
Yeah.
That's what Pep works with. All the biggest managers with the biggest clubs always have full control.
Is that why Chelsea can't get a top draw manager now? Is because they won't give the keys to a manager. They're going to say, you're a yes man, basically, and you're going to get dictated to from the top. So it's going to be a manager who wants to prove himself on the next level rather than somebody who has already done that.
It just seems so. Like, you have like, there was talk of Xabi Alonso as soon as the Chelsea job came in. It's like, oh, Liverpool would want to make a decision quick because he could go to Chelsea. And I remember saying to a few people, and they just started laughing. I was like, why would he do that? That's like, after going to Real Madrid, which is the exact same situation, why would you go and your next job be Chelsea? Because he won't get a third chance.
Yeah.
You can't take a risk on Chelsea. You just couldn't take a risk
There's no power.
You know?
The manager of Chelsea has no power, because every lad you're coming in, and if somebody doesn't play well, or you have to discipline somebody, or you need to have an honest chat, the fella you're chatting to probably has an 8-year deal in his back pocket.
Yeah.
So like, what are you going to say? Look, come on, you need to do this, that, or the other. You'll be gone before I am, mate.
And you're taking all the heat for the sporting director's work.
Yeah.
Well, you're the front man for somebody else's work. Well, so
it seems to me the perfect thing is, say like Emery, like, for example, like, everything runs through with him at Villa, but he's not doing it on his own, because you do have to say that the game has moved on. They can't be responsible for all recruitment. They can't be organising the buses and, you know, like, the full-on Ferguson control can't be there. But the manager needs to be the central point of it, the way Pep is, the way Emery is. And like, Emery has been linked with two jobs constantly, which is Manchester United and Real Madrid. and he should, in theory, go to either one of them. But I just think he'd really, really, he'd lose what he has.
Yeah.
And it'd be very hard to do what he does without all of that control, because the best managers are control freaks, let's face it. Like, they just are.
Yeah.
Klopp was the same. Klopp had to fight for that at Liverpool, you know, and he, you know, all the boys left because they thought they weren't getting a look in, and then Klopp left and they all came back in. And then they won the title, so I don't want to say they're all a disaster, but this year's transfers certainly didn't work out.
Hypothetically, if Emre did go into Real Madrid, I wouldn't see that ending well at all, because I don't think they need a tactician in Madrid. I think they need somebody just to get a hold of all the egos in the dressing room.
They need just Ancelotti for the rest of the time.
I don't think I've seen Emre get a little bit agitated in press conferences, but he doesn't look like he has a switch in him, like where he goes, oh God. And I think that's what them Real Madrid players need, rather than somebody to go out and get the tactics board and try and tweak everything.
What did you think of Real Madrid, the story of the fight between Tchouameni and Valverde? Valverde with a traumatic brain injury, they hear. We're hoping that's just like a concussion, but hit his head off the table.
Hit his head accidentally off the table.
Very nice dressing room, it's been pointed out to me, actually, when you see the pictures.
He released... Barcelona were trolling Real Madrid yesterday. They posted a photo of their players kind of like joking and training, and with the caption, one big happy family, which I thought was a nice little bit of trolling from the Barcelona admin. But Valverde actually released a statement saying that all of this has been blown out of proportion, is essentially what he's saying, that he had a disagreement, and during the argument, he accidentally hit his head off the table, causing a small cut on his forehead. I don't know how high the table needs to be to accidentally hit your head off.
A small cut.
Listen.
I don't know.
Any scraps in your day, Keith?
It's extremely common in professional football for fights to break out in dressing rooms, in pitches while you're training. The one of the best, I say best, but had a really good outcome for everybody else in the squad. I was training for Burnley, and I think it was pre-season. It must have been pre-season, because it was an 11v11, and we wouldn't generally do that type of stuff unless it was a Friday. But I was playing on the right wing, and somebody chipped the ball over the defence's head, and it was just going out of play. So I turned me back, and as I turned back around, there was a little bit of commotion, and all of a sudden it became clear that one player had headbutted another player and busted his nose, and there was claret everywhere. So Sean Dyche's reaction was to the player who threw the headbutt had to pay for the whole Burnley squad to go up to St Andrews for the weekend. He had to pay for the round of golf for everybody's accommodation, and he had to pay for the first round that night as well. Really expensive.
That's expensive. I was going to say, for a footballer.
It worked out, because I was fairly close with the fella who threw the headbutt, and we sat down together and tried to work out whether it was a cumulative to 2 weeks' wages or not, and it was just under. And I think Sean Dyche had weighed it up and thought, will I do him 2 weeks' wages, or will I try and get some value squad out of two weeks' wages? And that's exactly what he's did. And the two players in question went on to be very good friends again.
When a club finds a player... So I always just thought that was a weird thing that they were just able to do. And then you see it in that it's in players' charts and stuff like that. Yeah. So it goes into a kit. Like, I presume the club doesn't just take off wages of a player because they got a red card or whatever. Like, it's,
Well, it depends what the card is for.
Does it not go to... Does it not go somewhere? Like, sure, the club just can't withhold money from people legally.
Usually would go into a kitty, but if you get booked for dissent, it comes out of your wages for the English FA. It's £8.
Oh, right.
Well, it was when I was playing. It was £8 for the yellow. I remember seeing it on the payslip, English FA, £8. £8, all right. But £8. I think it might be £12 or something for a red, but that's the one thing the clubs won't cover. Dissent. Yeah. If you get booked for dissent, they say they're not covering the tackles. No problem, but dissent, you're on your own.
Yeah, but if you get that fine 2 weeks' wages, that's a player kind of agreement thing, is it, rather than something the club are actually doing to you?
You can go and fight, you can get the PFA involved, but generally the club will weigh all that up beforehand and know whether they have a thing. But I actually got done, Eddie Howe tried to do me 6 weeks' wages. It's the most allowed in the rules of it and all this and that. Now, he ended up going back to Bournemouth about 2 weeks after this, and I was fighting it with the PFA and was about to get off it on a loophole, but Sean Dyche came in and just squashed it. And again, that's another reason he got me on side. He said, look, that was under the other manager, nothing to do with me, so clean slate. But yeah, 6 weeks wages was a
6 weeks is mad.
That's crazy.
Six weeks was tough.
That's insane.
Roy Keane had a mad one on the overlap last week. He said that he was once fined. I think he said €250,000 or £250,000 at the time. Or was it 120?
2 weeks wages.
You saw, yeah, literally, like that was it. Like I think it was for the Haaland situation. He got, and like just shows
a lot of money back then. And like, he was like, God,
yeah, because he was even saying like, even when you're earning that much money, that is a lot of money, regardless of who you are. So
the fines really ramp up around Christmas. Is the Christmas key.
Christmas party.
Leave your jumper out, it's like a €500 fine. You have a water bottle out, or if you walk into the training room with your boots on, fines everywhere. Unbelievable. Right. So, but the kitties would be ridiculous.
I experienced that for the first time in Australia. I was playing football out there, and they did fines for the club players. I was little. Well, obviously, it wasn't to the extent of yours, but it was for little stupid things. Like if you got nutmegged in training, it was a fiver. If you said something stupid during the match, it was a tenner. Like they had little bits and pieces. It was absolutely no rules about it. It was just random shit. But it paid for the end of season. Jolly up then, which it was great crack. At the same
Did you have a court at the end of the season or anything like that?
Well, we used to have it every Friday. It wasn't a court. It was more of, well, yeah, there was a bit of a court. We had a spinning wheel.
Like a kangaroo court. Just
so if you did something wrong, generally there'd be picture evidence as well, because people, you know, got really into it at one point. So if you left you'd have a skip that you had to put all your stuff into your training kit. And if you didn't do it, if it was on the floor, somebody would take a picture.
Right.
And on Friday morning, you're sitting there in a team meeting and all of a sudden, Keith Tracy didn't put his top in. You're on the back foot. You have to explain yourself, but then photo evidence pops up, and like the wheel was brilliant. So trivial little things like that, the manager wouldn't want to get involved with a heavy fine, because it's not, you know, the crime doesn't fit the punishment. But you'd spin a wheel and you could get €50 back, so €50 charitable bet. Or you, if you landed on V on the wheel, you'd have to V'd your legs. Like Z, there was a song called Zim Zimmer, and you'd have to dance to that song for a minute if you'd done Z. It was B was the worst. You didn't want to spin on a B was boy band, so you'd spin another four times, and the numbers that come up on the wheel, those four squad numbers would come, and you'd create a boy band. Unbelievable. So, but honestly, it would make you not want to do that stuff. So it wasn't a heavy handed fine, it was just a little bit of crack. But you sing in front of your mates for a minute and all of a sudden you're thinking, I'm not doing that again, don't want to do that.
Yeah.
There was a lap dance as well.
Oh, I think you've talked about this before.
Yeah. One of my fondest memories.
We've got 10 minutes left. We haven't even touched the paper yet, Dara. If you want to, we'll leave Aston Villa on. Well, we haven't talked about them about 15 minutes, but we'll leave it on the Braeburn question.
Yeah, we have our very late Braeburn question this week, giving away a €100 voucher. It's a WhatsApp only competition. So answer this question and you win. When was the last time? Well, give me the year, not the match or anything else involved. The year in which Aston Villa last reached a European Cup final. I know the answer to this, Mick, but you're not allowed to answer.
No, I won't answer. Can I?
WhatsApp only.
Can I give an extra bit of information, though?
Go for it.
Against the same nation team as they will be playing in the Europa League final. Okay.
Yeah, so Texas 087-9180-180, only WhatsApp.
Okay, 087-9180-180. If you want to get any comments in or questions for Keith over the rest of the show, just quickly go through some of the papers today in the Irish Examiner. That old Munster final feeling is back for Fitzgerald. So Cork and Kerry playing this week, Maurice Fitzgerald interview there. And probably more interestingly, and we'll be talking to Quinny a little bit later on, Macmillan issues thinly veiled back me or sack me message for Munster. So Clayton Macmillan, we'll be hearing from this a little bit later on. Interesting press conference yesterday where he talked about the support or lack thereof that he might be getting from Munster. He's there till the end of the season, he says, Dara, and we don't know after that.
Yeah, he made a comment along the lines of, don't want to misquote him, but it was some things need to change in order for me to feel like I have the backing of the club, which is, you know, pretty...
It's been a messy situation, and in fairness, whatever about Munster's performances this year and all, they don't want to be starting again, I don't think, next year. No. So not great. We'll see how that goes, and we'll talk to Quinny about it. The Daily Telegraph, Air we go. And I just put lots of pictures of John McGinn and his celebration that Dara thinks is stupid.
No. Jesus, said that in confidence.
Oh my God. He didn't know what it was. It is a stupid celebration.
I didn't
realize
it is sentimental.
It's his nephew who wears glasses and he did it for him. And
that's lovely.
But air we go, because the pinch, you got to get a picture of Prince Philip up anytime he's at a match. I have to say, though, Keith, right? They cut to him a lot last night, like far too much. Let's face it. He does kind of come across as a genuine enough fan, though, doesn't he?
Yeah, when that second Aston Villa goal went in and the camera panned to him, you could see the celebrations were there. And even, I assume it's his bodyguard in the background was high-fiving him as well. It looked like they were really into it. But, yeah, you have no problem with it. He looks like he's enjoying it, and he's there because he wants to be there, not because, I'm a Villa fan and I need to be seen.
He does seem to be a little bit more into it than your average kind of like politician / royal, but... I did enjoy towards the end of the game that I don't know who that guy is either, as his minder or his personal secretary or whatever it is, they were singing songs or whatever, and he kind of really got into it and started shouting, and then I could just notice him getting really self-conscious and just kind of stopping, like Philip was going for it, but your man just kind of like went, oh, I've just gone a bit, that was a little bit inappropriate there, I think.
Probably got a glimpse of himself on the big screen at all.
Might have, another one here in the Mirror. That's Gunnar Sting. Fans facing huge bill for Budapest Cup final. That's what's going to happen. Arsenal fans are facing a staggering bill of up to £15,000 to get to the Champions League final. This is the way it is at the moment. It's all of our conversation about the World Cup. I know I looked up tickets for Istanbul, like, in the group stages, just to kind of see, would I do a speculative flight or whatever? And even then, it was like, it was a bit much. And that's only for the Europa League. So you can imagine what Budapest is like. Now, the story going around this week, now, we question its veracity, don't we? Like, it might not be true, but everyone will have seen it at this stage. Arsenal fan, back in like August or September, pure faith, booking.com room in Budapest for £150, delighted with himself, posted up when they qualify on Tuesday night with a very self-satisfied, look what I did. And then we get a message saying that a Spurs fan used the booking number that he posted to cancel the booking.
Oh, well played.
I didn't see that. Oh, jeez.
That's why you don't put your life up on social media.
There is questions as to whether you can just use a booking.com reference number to cancel a booking, in which case it could be a hoax by this Spurs fan to suggest that he's done this and actually hasn't, and it's a Photoshop of some kind. But I have to say, you could both feel immensely sorry and like that this is like a terrible act, and also think it's incredibly funny and clever at the same time, and his football rivalry at its very best.
Yeah, it's going to that extra length to just get one over Arsenal. In a bad season for Spurs, you're still after them.
Yeah. More stuff in the Mail here. It's more on Munster, more on John McGinn, but also this is a very interesting story. Probe into Southampton spy caught in a bush. Middlesbrough caught what is thought to be a Southampton first team analyst allegedly recording their training session from a bush in a sensational repeat of the Marcelo Bielsa Spygate furore. An individual was spotted and approached by club staff yesterday morning at Borough's Rockcliffe Park training centre 48 hours before they host Southampton in the Championship playoff semi-final first leg tomorrow afternoon. It's claimed the man deleted video footage and pictures from his mobile phone and refused to identify himself. He then left the site of the training ground and made his way into a nearby Rockcliffe Hall hotel owned by Borough Chairman Steve Gibson before changing clothes in the toilet and leaving.
Oh, jeez.
It's all fantastic. I have contacted the EFL. I had to leave in the changing in the toilet thing. It's quite a needless little bit of information that's in that piece, but Spygate's back.
Oh, I love it. It happens every couple of years. You hear a story like this. Well, it's just like
lads in a tree.
It doesn't matter.
Donegal were up to this for a while.
Jimmy Guinness had a man down in a tree there this year, I think, potentially. Jimmy Guinness actually, I think, not to make it all, but
allegedly. I don't know what Jim did.
He allegedly built a wall around the Donegal train when he came in for his first year. It's great stuff because it's a reminder that no matter how elite sport gets, there's no limit to where human pettiness can drive you.
It's an absolute fluff, though, isn't it? What are you going to learn in a bush? That you like Southampton have played a whole season in the Championship now.
Some of us have had formative years.
He whipped the laptop out, get the stats book out, get Wii Scout out, do whatever you like.
Yeah.
You don't
there's
need to
so
sit in a
much
bush.
Information
you
there.
Really
like, yeah,
there's you, nothing that they've gone back with to Southampton have come back with and gone, tell you what, this is what they're going to do.
Yeah.
They haven't uncovered
anything. Are Middlesbrough going to do something in the playoff semi-final that is completely new that they've never done before? Because you have every information of everything that they've ever done on the pitch.
Yeah, and they've got
and that manager's
success.
Only been there for a few months anyway.
Yeah, so there's nothing. Like, they're not going to come into a diamond in midfield all of a sudden. And I just think it's crazy. And you get the team sheet an hour and 15 minutes, whatever it is, before kickoff. You can generally put the shape together after you get the players involved. Really, you know, and you're running through every scenario as well. If Southampton do this, we're going to do that. If Middlesbrough do that, we're going to do this. It means nothing. It's just silly stuff.
It does illustrate, though, how important and how big and how, like, finance-wise, how big these playoffs are and how much they matter, especially for a team like Southampton or whoever who have to bounce back up. And if they don't, they could be stranded, and you get into this position where you just don't have the finances to get out of the Championship again. I'm looking forward to these games, though. They do have there's such a great history to them, a great energy to them. The Villa West Brom ones, the semi-finals a few years ago, were just unbelievable. Obviously, we all remember the Leicester Watford that time as well. Hull Millwall tonight's going to be interesting, because I don't know if anybody's quite ready for Hull to be back in the Premier League. Although I have to say, I think it'd be a great story for John Egan. Given the kind of resurrection of his career, awful like two and a half year injury that he had, he's playing brilliantly again. But Millwall in the Premier League, they weren't too far off automatic promotion.
Yeah, it'd be a nice change. I'm not sure many away fans would welcome going to the Den next season in the Premier League, because even now still, have you ever read Eamon Dunphy's diary that he did?
Long time ago,
The way he describes it is not too dissimilar to what it is currently. So it'll tell you how much things have changed in Millwall. But I think it would be the ultimate robbery of faith if we got Millwall in the Premier League and West Ham go down. I think West Ham, if Millwall stay in the Championship and West Ham do go down, that's a very, very tasty Championship fixture that will have everybody watching. Yeah. So,
want to see it in some capacity.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know, I think it would be interesting. Who do you fancy out of those four? Southampton, to be honest, are probably on the kind of like the biggest upward trajectory, given how they started the season. And obviously there is the Azaz and Manning factor there as well.
Yeah, I probably would fancy Southampton. I'd be leaning towards them. But if you were asking me who I want to go up, it would be Millwall. I think it's just putting a cat amongst the pigeons. I played down in Millwall a couple of times in the Den. I mean, that was at a time when Danny Shittu was the captain of Millwall, and he used to stand at the front of the tunnel with no top on and bark like a dog. Honestly, we can laugh now because it is a bit funny, but it's the most intimidating thing I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah. When you say bark, you mean like...
You're like, woof. Like, just right. As bad as that, but he would turn. The muscles in this fella's back, by the way. As you're standing looking at his back thinking, well, I'm not walking past him, you walk past him. He was a scaredy, scaredy bloke, and then you come out of the tunnel and all of a sudden the wave of abuse hits you. It's a tough place to go and play our football. When people talk about, could you do it in a rainy night in Stoke? Can you do it in Millwall?
Yeah.
Can you do it in Millwall? And I mean this in a nice way. It's horrible. Absolutely horrible. Nobody wants to play there.
As soon as you walk out the tunnel, it starts like the crowd are at you straight away.
Players who played for them, though, talk really well, like highly of it. Like Richie Sadley obviously spent his career there, but he loves Millwall. You know what I mean? It does obviously have this reputation as well, but I don't think that's all there is to the club either. You know what I mean?
They've got some lovely little technicians. I'm delighted Barry Bannon left Sheffield Wednesday. Obviously, Wednesday are in a really, really, really bad place at the minute. He left for financial reasons, and he's gone to Millwall, and obviously he's in the middle of a playoff push now. So I'm delighted for Barry on a personal level. I don't know, I would back Southampton. I think Millwall will be a step too far, even Hull possibly a step too far, and with the Irish lads Southampton have, I'd like them to do.
Alright, Keith's going to stay with us. Thanks a million, lads. Off the ball breakfast with Viagra Connect, 50 milligram film coated tablets, contains sildenafil for adult men with erectile dysfunction. Maximum dosage 150 milligram tablet per day. Always read the label, buy online at viagraconnect.ie, subject to suitability following pharmacist consultation. Time for the cash machine.
Off the ball's cash machine.
Yep, taking part is easy. We're about to give you an amount. You take note of it, enter, and if we call you later on today, you give us the number, you win the cash. The cash machine amount is €305,000. To enter, text OTB to 57557. That's 57557. The cost is €250 plus your standard message rate to play. You have to be over 18. You're playing across the Go Loud network of stations. Full terms and conditions are at offtheball.com. Get your entry in by 3 p.m. today. The cash machine then will randomly pick a number, and you, and it could be you that we are calling. Answer within five rings, tell us the prize amount, and the cash is yours. So €305,000. Text OTB 57557. That's 57557.